This is Martha Farah, and I am at the first annual meeting of the Neuroethics Society interviewing Turhan Canley. Turhan is a friend and colleague whose work in neuroscience spans the molecular systems and behavioral level of analysis of the human brain. Turhan, let me begin by just asking you a little bit about that work that you do that spans so many different levels of analysis. Can you tell us a little bit about molecules to brains to behavior?
Yeah, sure, I'd love to. Thanks, Martha. I'm particularly interested in individual differences in behavior, and in particular, individual differences in emotion and individual differences in personality traits. Now, when you look at personality traits, and people have for decades now, you realize that there are almost equally strong components of genetic determinants and environmental determinants that factor into the behavior that we observe in others. And in a sense, I'm interested in studying the relation of these two variables in how it shapes behavior. Now, behavior to me is only generated by neural circuits, so that translates into studying neural circuits as well. So the research that we do in my lab has to do with understanding individual variability within the molecular structure of genes and in the molecular structure surrounding genes, the epigenetics, as well as individuals' unique life experience that shapes them as well, and the underlying mechanisms by which these two factors come together and interact.
That's interesting, because a lot of people, I mean, I think the man on the street and even to a certain extent the scientist and bioethicist on the street tends to assume that if a behavior has a demonstrable brain basis or a cause in the brain, that it must be genetic. But what you're saying, and of course I agree with that, is that the brain is shaped both by genetics and experience. Are there any examples that you could sort of give us of, you know, maybe from your research, how life experience alters brain function in concert with genetics?
Yeah. In a way, one of the most prominent fields within neuroscience and within cognitive neuroscience is the area of learning and memory. And in fact, even going back to my undergraduate student days, I was engaged in research involving the neural basis of learning and memory. So in my own work, that has a pretty long trajectory. Every time we have an experience that we remember, it leaves an imprint in the brain. Something physically changes in the brain. And ultimately, that actually involves the production of new proteins and connections being formed and so forth, all of which is regulated by genes. So in that sense, the interaction of genes and experience is kind of obvious for those of us who study plasticity in the brain. But at a deeper level, we, in the last, you know, decade or so, we as a field have begun to appreciate more and more that genes are not all the same, that even though we share all the same genes, that there's variability, common variants within these genes that have some play with respect to our own reactivity to the world. And more recently, that also seem to lead to differential interactions and with the world and different health outcomes.
So let me ask you to make this a little more specific and concrete. Mm-hmm. What's an example of perhaps a personality trait, mm-hmm, or a sort of characteristic emotional response, you know, something that we can recognize when we think of, mm-hmm, the people we know? Oh yeah, you know, so-and-so is very hot-headed, mm-hmm, and somebody else, you know, nothing fazes her. Are there traits like that that you've been able to understand the interplay between genes and life experience?
Oh, absolutely. I think the best example of that is a trait called neuroticism or harm avoidance. So people who score high in this personality trait tend to be fairly anxious, tend to be fairly reactive to negative experiences. They may dwell more than others on negative events of the day and ruminate. And about a little over 10 years ago, in 1996, there was a seminal publication that was published in Science in which it was reported that there is a variation within a gene that has to do with the neurotransmitter serotonin. And that depending on which variants of the gene you had, you were significantly more likely to score high in this personality trait. In a way, this was the first demonstration of a molecular genetic marker being associated with a very complex behavior. And to me, it's sort of the birth year of what I call molecular psychology. Molecular psychology being the application of molecular biology and its tools to the study of behavior. And in 1996, this association was made, that a variation within this gene called the serotonin transporter gene maps onto variation within complex behaviors of humans that have to do with anxiety and harm avoidance, and that we commonly refer to as a trait of neuroticism. Now, people who tend to score high in neuroticism are more likely to be developing mood disorders, for instance, such as depression. But by itself, this is not a very good predictor. And the same is true for this genetic variation in the serotonin transporter. By itself, that genetic variability is not such a good predictor for subsequent likelihood of mood disorders. However, if you put that genetic vulnerability together with a life of adverse life experiences, then you begin to look at gene-environment interactions. And so one of the next big steps in the sort of development of this field that I call molecular psychology was a study by Avshalom Kaspi and colleagues, in fact, two studies, both of which were also published in Science in 2002 and 2003, where they looked at the interaction between genetic variation and life experience. And in one of those two papers, they talked about the serotonin transporter gene and how, depending on which variant of the gene you carried, there was a differential likelihood of depression or depressive symptoms emerging if you had a lot of life stress. So in other words, let me just to make that a little bit more clear. If you have the allele that's associated with low neuroticism, then even in the presence of life stress, you just have a marginally elevated likelihood of developing some mood disorder. But if you carry one copy of the vulnerability version of the gene, or maybe even two, that likelihood goes way up, but only if you have experienced life stress. So in that analysis, it really takes both. It takes the vulnerability gene, the variant of the vulnerability gene, together with a stressful life experience to sort of draw out this vulnerability and make it become a kind of a diagnosis. And that's the essence of the gene-environment interaction.
So what happened to the brain in all of this? It sounds like you're going straight from molecules, the serotonin transporter promoter, to personality and depression. Does looking at the brain help you in any way?
Yeah, I think it does. And in fact, that's where some of our work has been done. We've been looking at brain mechanisms of how this gene works. The first group to do that was actually Daniel Weinberger's group at NIH, and in a study that was published in 2002 by Hariri and colleagues. And what they did there was to show that part of the brain circuit that is well known to those neuroscientists that study emotion, the amygdala, was differentially activated in response to emotional stimuli as a function of whether you had the vulnerability version of the serotonin transporter gene or not. We've published something along those lines a few years later, and our work has been more about the mechanism by which that might take place and how to interpret the way this gene may work on these neural circuits, as well as looking at the interaction of this gene with people's life experience. And so what we find is that in brain circuits involved in emotional processing, but also quite a number of other brain circuits, we see evidence for these gene-environment interactions, meaning that the degree of activation you see in these brain circuits cannot be fully predicted by just knowing about the gene or just knowing about a person's life history. You need to have both. And so it points the way for future work and more detailed brain mapping studies that may look at this gene, but maybe many other genes as well, and take into account much more detailed information about a person's life history to understand the functioning of these circuits. And I think from that, we will learn a lot, not just about basic neuroscience and how the brain generates behavior, but also be able to potentially develop more precise biomarkers that can identify whether somebody's vulnerable for a particular kind of psychopathology or behavioral disorder than somebody else. And further down the road, perhaps get a better sense of the effectiveness of interventions that that we would develop based on that information.
Wow, so you're saying that by scanning somebody's brain, doing a functional brain scan, you can see the, you know, in effect, the combined action of their genetic, you know, inheritance from their parents and the level of stress they've had to endure in their lives and the interaction of those things that leave them vulnerable to disorders like depression and just certain kinds of personalities.
We're beginning to do that now. I mean, we're getting to that point. We're not quite there yet, but we keep refining the methodologies and we keep refining the way we can handle the ever-increasing bandwidth of the data that we can analyze. So, you know, 10 years ago, there was a focus on a single gene polymorphism. By now, there's a set of maybe a dozen or so that kind of keep being reported on in the literature. But the technology has far outpaced our ability to focus on this kind of genetic variation, because now we're looking at array technology, gene array technology, that lets us look at many thousands of genes in one experiment. At the same time, our brain imaging methodologies become more and more sophisticated as well. And I think at this meeting, we will get a sense of that when it comes to things like predicting behavior on the basis of relatively limited scan data that are analyzed in very sophisticated ways. And all of that we have to put together to be able to predict behavior.
Predicting behavior sounds like something that has ethical implications. Let me ask you how close we are to that now. For example, you must scan, 10, 20, 30 subjects in a typical experiment, and people mm-hmm. with a range of values on, let's say, neuroticism.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at one of their scans, how good a guess can you make as to their level of neuroticism or risk of depression? How revealing are these scans at this point in the development of the method?
Not revealing enough to make any firm conclusions about any particular individual. When the stakes aren't high and I'm just having fun looking at the data, I tend to be pretty good at making a guess as to what kind of personality score I could expect from an individual's functional activation pattern. But it wouldn't be scientifically solid enough that I would want to have to testify on behalf or against somebody based on that data alone if we were, you know, in the middle of a court case or something was really at stake.
Okay.
So I think it really depends what we're talking about. Are we talking about a casual judgment in the same way that we can make a casual judgment when we have an encounter with a stranger in a coffee store? Or is it something where much more is at stake and you really want to be sure that whatever judgment you make is rigorous?
Okay, but when you play that little game for yourself, you know, of looking at a scan and saying, that person looks pretty neurotic,
yeah.
I assume you then kind of check and see what the answer is.
Yes.
Are you reasonably accurate in that low stakes?
I'm pretty accurate.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah?
pretty accurate.
Very interesting.
Yep.
Interesting. Okay, I think that's a great neuroethical point to end on, both the potential, you know, in the process of being realized, to learn important things about people from their genes, from their brain scans, and also the appropriate cautions about not getting carried away with those predictive abilities before they've really been proven.